speak to it.
All right, good morning. How we feeling? We're feeling cold? All right, we're going to have to like incorporate some physical kinesthetic things in here to get the blood flowing, right? You turn the air off. You're like, the blower is on. I felt it, you know, on the way in. All right, so we're going to heat things up with some great learning for you all. So a planned fail and a book giveaway, but was it? And now I'm counting on the honor system. Who was first in this room? Does anyone know who was the first person? Like, was that you? Okay. Well, then you get the door prize. I got three door prizes. Give her a hand clap. Woo! Like Oprah favorite things. Free copy of Rick's book. Building learner confidence. I'm assuming you don't already have it. Now you do. All right. I got two more, so just hang tight throughout our time here today. Welcome to the final day of the Michigan School Testing Conference. If we haven't met before, my name is Dr. Stephen Sneed. I'm a proud employee of Oakland Schools as a supervisor of curriculum assessment. I am also on the board of directors for the Michigan Assessment Consortium, and I'm a part of the executive committee that's putting on the conference. So hopefully you have had a good conference experience. If you hadn't, please let us know because we want to improve that. You don't need to say the rooms are cold. I get it. I've experienced that with you.
Everybody knows.
Yes, yes. And I let my colleagues introduce themselves.
I'm Nanette Suarez. I'm the Data and Assessment Coordinator in Farmington Public Schools.
Hi, I'm Julie Wakefield. I am from Wayne Westland Schools, where I'm an instructional coach for grades 9-12 over our four high school buildings.
And I want to thank my partners for joining me here today. It's a long road to get to this complete slide deck. They know exactly what I'm talking about. So I always like to make friends. You're going to make new friends and colleagues here. This is definitely not going to be one we're going to talk at you for 75 minutes. Learning is, for me, a sociocultural experience. So, think about a time in school or work when you felt really confident. I got this. I'm in my bag. What contributed to that confidence? So I'm going to give you a solid 60 seconds, get that story straight in your head. Maybe you go back 2 weeks, maybe you go back two decades. What made you confident? Form a trio, three people, 3 minutes. Give everybody about a minute to share out what made them confident, what contributed to that in school or work. About 3 minutes or so, I'll check in. And we're going to look for some friends to share on the back end. So, of course, in that time, you know, your parent probably told you don't talk to strangers. That rule is still applicable. So make nice, make new friends, do, hey, my name's this, that, the other, so that you're not strangers. Then dive into that. Sound good? All right, three people, introductions, and what made you confident? Go.
Yeah.
the two of us had a snow day.
So about 30 more seconds. You're going to bring that conversation to close. All right, and if you could bring that conversation to a close, if you bring that to a close. Boom, there it is. Okay, looking for three friends to share very quickly. What contributed to your confidence? What contributed to your confidence? And I'm looking for three friends. I got two.
Knowledge of my topic. So having all that knowledge and then doing it multiple times builds up that confidence. So then I got really good at it. I was like, I got this.
Knowledge of the topic. Thank you. And your name again? I didn't ask you. Nikki. Me. Nikki, where are you from?
Roseville.
Hey, shout out to Roseville, Macomb County.
I'm Margo. I'm at Royal Oak High School. Yes, yeah, I know. Someone told me to meet you, yeah, so yeah. Hi. feedback from colleagues that were on the right path type of thing. Yeah.
So like some mentorship from those further down the road. Nice, nice, nice. Even folks in the trenches with you.
Yeah, yeah.
Some feedback. Nice. Feedback, knowledge. In the back. All right. Coming all the way back.
Good morning. I am Dr. Tara Reed. Currently, I am with Eagles Nest Academy in Flint, Michigan. But I was sharing with my colleagues here in the back of the room that for me, what drives my confidence is when others have confidence in me, when I seemingly and don't have it in myself. I was sharing with them an experience that I had where in which I was brought in to help transform the educational infrastructure of a medical school, and everybody heard about my reputation and they just knew I could do it, and I was frightened to death, but we ultimately succeeded in the work. So for me, it was having knowing that others have confidence in me.
Thank you, Dr. Reed. So that reciprocal confidence, right? Right? So wonderful. And so, you know, what we're going to really talk about here today, you know, kind of based on some of the research out of Rick Stiggins and the book, Giving Our Students the Gift of Confidence, which my colleagues will talk about in depth in a bit. But I think is really important. And why might that be important today? So let's talk about stress. We've all been stressed, right? And stress is a normal part of life. It's not a bad thing per se. It's a thing, you know? It's a natural reaction your body has when changes or challenges occur. There are many physical, emotional, and behavioral responses. Everyone experiences stress from time to time. So I don't want to set the tone that you can make your school stress-free. That's impossible. We need to empower and equip our kids with grit and consistency and stability and that stick-to-itiveness, because they're going to encounter stressful things in life. They're going to encounter stressful things academically. Lord knows, for those of you who've written a dissertation in the room, like, oh my God, when will this end? That's stress. So stress ain't bad. Chronic stress is the thing we want to be on guard about. And chronic stress is that consistent feeling of being pressured and overwhelmed over a very long period of time. And so it's the chronic stress. And the chronic stress is a couple of nasty things. The increased chemical responses in the brain constantly puts you in this fight or flight mode, temporarily, it's necessary, it's advantageous. We've evolved for society. Humans made it, right? So that stress response was helpful. But constantly being under that stress is a problem in our schools. That can breed anxiety. So what do we know about anxiety? What is anxiety's effect on cognition and even the body? So when we're experiencing anxiety, we have trouble concentrating or making decisions. Now, we don't have to go through any further bullet points right there. What do we want kids to do when they're taking an assessment? We want them to concentrate and make decisions. We want them to make good decisions. So if kids are experiencing anxiety or anxiety stressors, we've automatically discounted the validity of that assessment because the assessment or the assessment process or even the school process is contributing to these conditions. Feeling irritable, tense, or restless, experiencing nausea or abdominal distress. So anxiety just isn't mental. It also manifests in the body physically. Heart palpitations, sweating, tremulous, shaking, troubleshooting, having an impending sense of danger, panic, or doom, right? So things that are manifesting mentally, but things that are also manifesting physically. How many of you have ever seen this graphic representation, the stress bucket? You've seen it before. All right. So we got one person. So new learning for lots of us. So again, stress being a normal part of life, stuff happens to you, right? A kid gets hurt at school. Your spouse has a medical emergency. Your boss plopped a big grant on your desk that you had to complete, you know, in 24 hours. Again, stress is natural. You have things in your life that are de-stressors, that are taking away those things. So seeing friends and connecting with people, exercise, rest, fun, relaxation, music, hobby, self-care, meditation, eating healthy. All of those things are helping to alleviate that stress. When we talk about in the context of school, these are things, and I like to tell people all the time, school is a barrier. School is a barrier. Classrooms are a barrier. When we talk about what are the barriers to eliminate, schools and the process of schools in and of themselves are stressors for kids. It's not about all the stuff that's happening outside. I know sometimes we educators say, well, you know, the parents are going through a lot. They're going through this. That may be true. Yes. And being in school is the stressful experience. So as research tell us, elevated academic stress and anxiety, this is a study. It was a bunch of kids in study, I think over 40,000. And so what they did, they did a basic assessment of stress over these kiddos, and I think most of them were in middle school. 68% of students reported moderate to severe academic stress, and 45% showed moderate to severe anxiety. Female students exhibited higher stress and anxiety levels compared to males, and that was statistically significant. Major predictors of that stress include academic workload, fear of failure, and lack of social support. I could definitely tell you in Oakland County, for some of our very high-performing schools and districts where you might think, oh, man, they got it on easy street, some of those school leaders will also tell you there, because the performance expectation is so high, kids are getting stressed out, and they've seen upticks in mental health system referrals because the expectation, you didn't get an A+, you weren't in the 99th percentile, you bringing shame on our school and our family, right? So some of those things reinforced by the school culture can actually potentially have a deleterious effect. So there's another study. Yeah, this one had like 50,000 kids in it, systematic review. Test anxiety impacts all of these in a negative way. I want you to turn and talk with your partners next to you. Which do you think was hurt the most? So which was the higher negative impact? Was it reading, math, academic self-competence, or self-efficacy? So what did anxiety hurt the most? But again, it hurt them all. So when kids were anxious, the results on these outcomes were lowered on all of them. Quick turn of talk, 2 minutes. What do you think was the worst and why?
Because I print out the slides, I do, yes.
But I wouldn't, it wasn't what I predicted when I played the slideshow.
Okay.
I had a different guess.
Oh, did you pull this directly from Canva? Oh, good, I just made some adjustments this morning.
Oh, the PDF.
No.
But that's playing off of Canva right now on the Wi-Fi, on the internet.
Version.
Yes, it should be, yeah. This right here is a printout from Monday. So if you've added anything, yeah, that's fine.
What's the next one? I don't remember.
It's me.
Oh, that's you. That's you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Started talking about the book. Yeah.
So you printed this off on Monday?
Yeah.
Yeah, Mom won't be in there.
Yeah, that's fine. You know, we're doing four of them. Like, everyone's like, oh, I added. I'm like, as long as you didn't add slides to my spot, I'm good. Add as many slides as you want. And it normally just sits on the table. That's when it's for done.
All right, sensing that low. I'm looking for your prediction and the rationale why, and let me hear from, let's just say, two people this time or other. Two people. What do you think was most impacted and why? Coming here.
I came up with self-efficacy because that belief in themselves, if they're super duper anxious, that's the first thing to kind of crumble.
So we got one for self-efficacy. Who had something different? Or did you have the same, and then why?
I picked academic self-concept because I'm in a middle school, so I see like the transition from fifth grade where you're with one teacher and maybe two specials to six teachers, and you've always had it and never had to ask for help. And the need to ask for help questions their own internal intelligence of themselves. Like, oh, because I don't understand this, I'm not as smart as I thought I was. It's not what it means, baby. So that's why I voted for that one.
I'm always greedy. One more.
I also said academic self-concept, and I have a son who just started sixth grade and a gifted and talented school, and that is his, he doesn't think he's smart. And I'm like, you had to test to get in. But if he's not doing well, or he has to ask for help, or it's not as easy as it was in fifth grade, it's that whole, I'm not smart enough.
Saying you don't have to put on the red light. Correlation, R value, negative 0.21. That's a decent correlation in terms of regression of the higher than anxiety, the lower the reading achievement. So reading was at negative 0.21. Math, negative 0.2. So about in the ballpark of the same. Self-efficacy, 0.3 now. Now we're in the highway to the danger zone. And as the authors defined it here, my ability, my belief in myself that I can do a thing in a generalized context, but the one that was the most was the academic self-concept of who I am as a scholar. So I am a former high school teacher. I've only ever taught high school. I was a summer camp director for younger kiddos. But in my time in classroom and leading schools and high schools, and I can definitely tell you, when the kids are in ninth grade, there is a stubborn academic concept that they have of themselves sometimes that's really hard to shift, where they have really firm beliefs about who they are, how smart they are, and what they can and cannot do. And part of our assessing environment reinforces that. Whereas for me, I was one of those classic kids, the grade chaser, right? I need 95 points, not 94. How can I? I'm gamifying the system. And so getting an A for me was the thing. If I got an A minus, ooh, my feelings are hurt. But that academic self-concept for our kids who are struggling with anxiety, even acute anxiety or chronic anxiety, is literally killing their academic scholarship identity. And the more that persists over time, you've got this gap in kids that have a high academic self-concept. You know, I got it. It was easy. You know, da-da-da-da-da. And kids that are like, I'm not good at this. I'm not smart. Sometimes that's reinforced by the parent. I've heard parents come to me and say, like, you know, Mr. Sneed, as long as he passes with a D, I'm happy. Sometimes that academic self-concept is reinforced by professional staff. Need I say more? Right? But we're not going to just talk about the problem. I'm going to pass a mic to my dear colleague, Nanette. It's going to transition. Okay, so now we get clear-eyed on, like, what the problem is and what the relationship to assessing to anxiety is. What might we do differently to change the dynamic? So, Nanette.
Okay, so the basis of this session came from this book. So I had done a book study with Stephen, and Julie and I happen to both be in the teacher leader assessment specialist program. And so we're constantly looking at how assessment in our classrooms is going and how is it going for our kids. And so I will admit when we got this book, and I'm like, gift of confidence? Really? Like, we're talking about testing. We're talking about assessment. How is that going to work? And so I think Mac also did a book read. So this book is around. It's short if you ever want to read it. But I start to look through. And again, none of this is going to be like, oh, I've never seen this before. But it's all things. We were just talking about that focus on grades and ranking, right? It's similar to our keynote this morning, talking about that difference between the assessment of learning and the assessment for learning. And and we're also going to advertise FAME too, because both of us are FAME coaches too, right? Because we're going to talk about formative assessment. But like, a lot of times when we talk about grades and ranking, it's not just the outwardly, like the honor roll that's out there. It's also how they feel, right? Again, we were all just giving out so many examples of how a student feels based on, oh, I have to ask for help. Oh, I didn't get, like, this person's bragging about their score next to me, right? The medical example that they always talk about is of learning is the autopsy, right? I hate that word. But the assessment for learning is that quick checkup, right? So basically what we're looking at, and we're going to go through, I don't know, maybe I just had the word pillars in my head because I'm also doing equitable grading. But like four things, I call them four pillars, that are my big takeaways from this book. So the first one, again, not new to anyone, clear learning targets, right? Students can't hit a target they can't see, right? If they don't know what am I supposed to learn, they're just guessing, right? And again, we're all on a journey. And so when I was in the classroom still, like I would sometimes have my kids, I had seen someone do this on a math test where they grade, not grade, but they look through everyone's tests and they put a highlight line, right? And telling them everything above is correct and everything below you need to fix. But what if I didn't know it the first time I saw the test? And now I'm hearing
There's highlight lines. I don't know what to fix, and I haven't given them any feedback. I don't know what their learning target is. I'm just guessing what I need to fix. And the amount of my students who would just erase everything below and leave it blank, right? Because they didn't know what to do. So again, how are we making sure that they understand? So that's where that student-friendly rubric comes into play. Examples of high-quality work, showing them what the target is going to help. My second pillar is all about formative assessment. So looking at formative assessment, the quick check-in, it's not just happening in the moment. It is happening in the moment. It's not just at the end. It's the practice of the norm. So I have a love-hate relationship with exit tickets because, and I'm sure it's not just my district, when we first started talking about summative versus formative, exit tickets was the thing. So everyone was giving exit tickets on the way out of class, but then did nothing with them. What is the purpose, right? And you'll notice I purposely made sure that the exit ticket, if you're going to use it, is information for the student and the teacher. You have to do something with it, right? And then as a FAME coach, I'm sure that Julie has had this conversation with teachers too. Think, pair, share, right? Your kids are talking. In the amount of times that I talk to some of my colleagues and I'm like, you know, if you just walk around, listen to the room, that's formative assessment. No, it's not, Nanette. I can't take that to my admin. Yes, you can. Because you are observing, you're hearing what they're doing, and you're going to make changes based on what the kids need, right? And so, like, that think, pair, share, and there's more, you know, formative assessment practices and processes, but why are we not counting that? Why does it have to be a number? Why does it have to be a score? Why do we need to put it in the grade book, right? So thinking about how can I look at just practice to help them learn, to make sure they know where they're going. Feedback. Someone mentioned feedback earlier. So with feedback, okay, so task focused. Again, I know I did this. I'm 27 years in. But what I just said, good job, right? Or bueno, because I taught math and Spanish. I need to focus on the task, not just on the person, right? So if I'm telling them, good job, oh, great, you that's not telling them anything about the task, not telling them what they can improve. That highlight line was just telling them, hey, here's where you're at. But it doesn't tell them what they need to do in order to do better on that task. Huh, timely. I can take those exit tickets, I can take that assessment, but if they don't get it for another week to see that feedback, or 2 weeks, or 3 weeks, I don't know about you, but I've forgotten what I'm supposed to be looking at, right? The feedback on a final exam is too late, right? How about we have peer-to-peer feedback? It doesn't have to be the teacher all the time giving feedback, right? Megan and I were presenting yesterday on equitable grading, and like, you don't have to give feedback on every single thing as the teacher. You can pick what elements you're going to focus on that assignment, on that task, right? Having the peer-to-peer feedback, the students could also use the rubric to figure out their own feedback. You could also use, it may be a bad word, I don't know, everyone's choices. There are also AI tools that will give your students feedback as well, right? There are so many choices that we have nowadays. We can make sure that that feedback is timely so they can make a change, right? Because again, if we're trying to give students confidence, we need to make it so that this is something I can attain. I can get there, right? And that's the actionable part of it as well, right? What is it I need to do so that it's within reach? If I tell them 5 different things to fix, it's going to get overwhelming, right? Depending on the size of the assignment. If I give them 1 thing to fix, that's attainable. That's manageable, right? Again, we're trying to make them feel like they can reach their target. They can get there where they need to be. And then the last pillar is that student involvement. So I know I already mentioned feedback, but students using that rubric, learning targets to evaluate their own work. So again, back in the day when we all started looking at our eval and, ooh, you need to be checking on your kids' progress. I'm one of those teachers who did, hey, hold up your hands, fist to five on your understanding. Do you know how many kids would tell me they were at a five or a four? And I'm like, yes, we're good. And then they take the test. And I'm like, what just happened? They all said they knew what that they were comfortable, we're ready to move on next topic. So then I changed my mind. I'm like, okay, so now let's make scales in student-friendly language so they can figure out, okay, so if I can do this with whole numbers, I'm at a two or whatever. If I can do this with fractions, I'm at a three. That's my target, right? Making it clear for them what they have to get to, right? So that's where that self-assessment, they need those targets. The peer assessment part, again, I would tell my kids, give each other feedback, and they do the same thing I used to do. Good job! I had to, a middle school kid, I had to start out with giving them structured protocols. Here's a sentence stem that you can use, so you're not just constantly saying, good job. I liked what you did. I liked the colors of the lines you drew on the graph, right? I'm like, nope, it's got to be about the mathematics. It's got to be about their explanation. You have to give more. So again, and sometimes as an adult, I could use some sentence stems too. But again, we're trying to help the students not only have the confidence, but to take ownership, right? I also talked earlier, I think it was on Tuesday, we were talking about competency-based assessments, right? And again, if students are going to have those opportunities to figure out, hey, I'm ready to, I'm going to use Emily's phrase in her district, to level up, right? They need to own them where they're at in their learning. So whether they're using those scales, whether they're using assessments to help them figure out, hey, I'm ready for the next step, I'm good to go, right? Again, having them feel confident so that they're not just, oh, this is what she gave me or I got an F, right? Versus them understanding where they're going. So now we're going to look at in the real world. Do you want me to walk with paper? In case anyone does
that? Possibly.
Okay. All right, I'm going to bring you a story from the field, little boots on the ground here. We had the opportunity in Wayne Westland for Rick Stiggins to join us on a district-wide K-12 PD. And he spoke to us about his text, Give Our Students the Gift of Confidence. We also all got a copy of the book. But this quote was what really struck one of the teachers that I have the opportunity to work with closely. And it read, there's a funny thing about confidence. If you have lots of it as a result of past success, the occasional setback, not a problem. You just reload and power through. But if your confidence is thin, you may lack those inner reserves to keep going, and it's just easier to give in and give up. And so he took this and he thought about how this is so true for so many of the students that he sees in front of his classroom. And he immediately took action, and he thought, I'm going to give my students a small win. He was engaged in a world history for our 10th graders, and they were studying the Mughal Empire. Now, this three-part learning target is a portion of a smaller unit. There's no way that you could, you know, cover all three of those empires in one class period, but the focus of the day was on the Mughal Empire. And the end product was to create a Venn diagram of the three empires in terms of their political, social, political, and economic features. So to give him a start, give him a small win, he passed out all the whiteboards and the whiteboard markers, which immediately the kids were excited about because in high school, that's not usually a practice that happens in so many of our classrooms. So pull out your whiteboard, a sheet of paper, and your marker, the pen, or if you have a tablet, iPad, you can sketch. If you need some supplies, Nanette is going to give you one.
Oh, woo.
So during this lesson, I was in the classroom watching, observing, and so I was able to take part.
So he asked me, okay, I'm going to participate. Draw the Statue of Liberty from memory. Go ahead. Take a minute or two. We won't judge your art skills. No, this was formative assessment, not going in the grade book. Walking around and observing.
I finish early, so you have time. If you need to get them more time, I finish early. I think.
Yeah.
It's okay. Then we can be upset at the end early. Just waiting for that.
And of course, like in any classroom, you have students who are artists, and then you have students who are like, I don't draw. I still have mine on my iPad. There you go. Yeah, okay, see?
Is it a problem with my most vivid memory is Ghostbusters 2?
What was that song?
Is it Bobby Brown's song?
No.
You know the song?
Did you
want to
sing it?
No. Okay. The movie, but the song plays during the scene. I love that song.
Well, we got
a
mic.
It wasn't Take Me to Higher Love.
If you have your Statue of Liberty drawn, you want to just kind of flash it to a friend next to you. Come on. All right.
She's a high school person. I'm a middle school person.
You can't say that.
You can't say flash at all.
Keep your clothes on.
So I'm sure some of you felt some measure of success with your Statue of Liberty, artistic qualities or not. So Bobby Wood, this is the teacher that I worked with, I asked him, I said, I'm going to present on this, and I'd like to use what you've done, because I thought it was very powerful when I was there. And he took it and ran with it, and it was exciting. He said, I chose the Statue of Liberty for the quick draw because regardless of backgrounds or experiences, the majority of students have at least a vague idea of what the statue looks like. Likeness of a woman holding a torch in one hand, stone tablet, crown, etc. So they can confidently create something that at least resembles the statue. So here was their small win. We decided to pull three different levels, right, of what was drawn. You got the artist in the center, but even you would say, hey, this is the Statue of Liberty. They got it. They were enjoying it. They had experienced some success, even though they knew that they were going to engage in the Mughal Empire in learning about the social, economic, political aspects of that.
Okay. But you have so many
things. I do. So what that did was it primed effort. It reduced anxiety, and it increased engagement, just as it did in this room right now. So now we got the stretch. Okay. You're up. Draw the Taj Mahal from memory.
Steven,
You doing it?
I'm doing it.
Okay. Okay. So a little bit more difficult, but you've experienced a success. You're ready to try. Let's see.
You've been there.
I have been there. I also grew up with seeing photos of it from like Earth.
Yeah.
So, yes. Yeah. All right.
She's got a cultural proficiency leg up.
I forgot to put the actual picture.
This is a biased item. And Nanette's going to win.
Oh, are you drawing
the Macy girl is going to win.
So not inserted in this slide deck, unfortunately. I would, they're there. But the actual Taj Mahal, I did not insert the actual picture, but I'm sure you can Google it very quickly and see how close you are. Same three students. Does this have a little dot pointer? No? Yeah, right. The sign, yes. The very, like, I tried. I know I'm supposed to. There we go. So even a student who had a vague idea of the Taj Mahal, so there's a sign. This is the Taj Mahal. I get what I'm supposed to do. Not quite sure what it looks like, but here it is. So this was that stretch. Bobby says, the Taj Mahal is the second because it was... Working? Thank you. Usually students are able to at least create an architectural feature close enough... Our red example. So when they see a picture of it, they have that, yeah, that's what I was going for feeling, even if their picture wasn't all that close. When they see it, they likely have that, oh yeah, I know that thing feeling, which is exactly what happened in the classroom when I was there that day. I was sitting next to a group of students. She's behind me. She's drawing. She's thinking. And then she goes, oh heck, I'm going to give my Taj Mahal a mustache. And I turned around and I was like, oh. But when Bobby put the picture of the Taj Mahal up on the screen, she goes, oh yeah, I know that. Another funny part to that story was another student had realized that the Taj Mahal was on the cover of the world history book that they use. So they're like peeking and drawn, you know. But hey, use your resources, right? It's okay. So even though students are going into this lesson, they know nothing about the gunpowder empires. I don't. Or the Mughals specifically. He could prove to them that they know at least one thing related to the Mughal empires and build from there. That was their stretch activity. Now, all of this took... as long as it took us, 5-6 minutes. But it's important to keep it rigorous. So you're not just asking them to draw something random to get them excited, but you take a familiar task and you make the win targeted, and then you link it to a more difficult task. Now, throughout the lesson, Bobby continued to reference the Taj Mahal in terms of the economic and social, political aspects that he was hoping. And then he tied that back to the Statue of Liberty and pulled in some of those commonalities between the two. So he did like weave that first little win throughout the lesson. Small wins build our confidence reserves, resulting in persistence. You could try one tomorrow or next week. something familiar, something that makes success likely, and then connect it directly to the harder thinking. Now, this can not only be done in the classroom. I was thinking about administrators, too. We're sitting in a PD, which, you know, PD. Where could you engineer an early success for your teachers before you launch into that PD? So it would not only work with students, it works with adults as well. Confidence is built, but we can give it to them, but we have to build it. Now, Bobby's taken this idea and weaved it into other lessons throughout, and the whiteboards come out, and that's just a novelty in itself at the high school level. Students don't get to use that mode.
This is well rehearsed, people.
So, rounding out the playing, because I know we're going to have lunch in about 15 minutes or so, and I have two more books to give away. Are you excited? Does anybody already have it? Aside from our friend in the back. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Look, if you were in Oakland County, you better have this book. Okay. So, what are we trying to get at? What's the point of all of this? What can you do? Because I like it when we can leave a conference experience with like some concrete ideas to move us forward. Here's the magic sauce of the feedback. Feedback doesn't matter if you don't have an opportunity to do better the next go round. So anybody who's saying, I don't want to do retakes, I don't want to do redos, don't give any feedback then. What's the point? If I can't use this knowledge that I've gained in a future attempt to do better, you kind of shot yourself in the foot with your feedback. But the feedback has to be something other than turn your work in on time. That's not the feedback we're talking about. Feedback rooted in academic cognition. We have to shift the paradigm in our assessment and grading from one to compliance to one to cognition and scholarship. Too many times, like, that dynamic we have with students is very transactional. But I haven't flipped that on your head. If you did not pay your rent or mortgage this month, your landlord or your mortgage company is like, oh, well, I'll assign you a penalty. You can't turn in that payment now. Nope. Maybe you can try again next month. No, they're going to tell you, you need to make that payment. You're going to pay. You're going to pay extra, but you are going to pay, and you're going to pay next month on time. The penalty for not doing work is doing work. The penalty for not doing the work is doing the work. I know. So controversial. So to build that hope and resilience, offers their opportunities to revise at work or retake assessments based on feedback. That shifts that focus from getting a grade to mastering a material. This Bruce Higgins point, assessment becomes a pathway to success, not a final unchangeable judgment. It builds hope and beliefs in one's ability to learn. So some key takeaways, clear targets that the students know and understand, and they can self-assess in terms of where they are in relation to the goal. The target should never be getting an A. The target should really, if you're even doing like standards of grading, shouldn't be like getting a 4, right? Target should never be like a number, some abstract thing. It's got to be something concrete. I can identify author's main point in an informational text. How do you know that you can do that? Talk to me about your ability to do that. What are the text features you can use to identify author's main point? Where might it be located in the text? What are some of the words and syntax structures that authors use to signify their main point? All of these things can be taught, and the gift that we give our students, the gift of self-assessment, empowers them for lifelong learning. The assessment for four learning, frequent low-stakes practice, is key. The turn and talk, the discussion prompts are my favorite formative assessment technique. Exit tickets are my least favorite technique. But I like to flip that on the head. Entrance tickets, We enter into, because that allows me the opportunity to shape the learning experience while it's still malleable. Descriptive feedback, focus on next steps, not just scores. Psychology tells us some pretty clear evidence that if you put a score on a thing, whatever you wrote in terms of feedback is being completely ignored or definitely downplayed. So the descriptive feedback is key. And student involvement, make students active users of assessment. Have them design some of the assessment process. Heck, it takes a little while, although with AI you could definitely supercharge this. Have the students grade fictitious or real student work so that they have a concept. Well, what does, if you're on standards-based grading, what does a 4 paper look like versus a 2 versus a 1? What might be the characteristics of that? You need to take them through that cognitive enterprise. If you just give them the rubric, sometimes kiddos, particularly in their early learning, don't really have the mental muscle memory to be able to tell, well, what does, you know, use of transitional phrases look like in writing? I don't know. Here it is in this paper that's a 4. So then your papers serve as mentor texts for kiddos over time. In my old days, I had to like keep a good student paper and like blot out the name, and I hung on to it in a fold. Then I got real jazzy and snazzy, put it in a Google folder. Well, now you can have AI do it, right? Hey, AI, here's the task, here's the prompt. Give me an example of a student paper at, you know, give it your rubric. Give me an example of a 4 paper, a 2 paper, and a 1 paper. You, the human, have to verify, okay, these are good examples, and use that as a learning activity that prompts students into your writing activity. And you can do that in math, right? Showing your work. You can still do multiple choice tests, it's fine, but just make them show the work on the paper. And then show kids what's an example of work that is, you know, at a 4, 3, or 2 in terms of like very descriptive, least descriptive, or not descriptive enough. But showing kids evidence and evolving that takes time, but it's worth it. Yes, sir.
So a lot of examples that are great to me are when we as educators have control over the content and the timing.
So my question is about, these are good examples of how to address the anxiety when the educators or the teachers have control over those tests, the content and the timing. So I think a lot of the sources of anxiety and stress for students might be the test that we can't control the content or the timing, what I call the people in the lobby, or, you know, or the one that happens in the spring every year. So did Stiggins address this, or did you guys talk about this, or do these things then lead to the reduced anxiety when it comes to these bigger assessments?
That's a great question. I'm going to come back over to my BFF Nikki here. Where her thing was being prepared. So here's a controversial thing, and people give me the stank eye when I say it. I'm sorry, but I gotta say it. If I love you and I know the research, and if you got competing research, okay. But my read of the research, for example, when it comes to like test prep rallies, they don't do what you think they're doing. And in some respects, there's some research that says, well, that actually heightens anxiety around the thing, because now you're getting, oh my God, the whole thing in the gym and everybody's getting excited, da 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 da. And I don't know how to do linear equations. That's on the PSAT. What? So we raise kiddos' anxieties by some of the big energy things people put on. I see their shirts made. They say like, oh, you got it, da 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 da. And me, as a person, you know, sits in ISD or systems of, I'm like, let me take that money and put it into teacher professional development so that teachers are better equipped to prepare students for that thing. I mean, and that's me. So simple, both simple and complex, but the more prepared learners are for the task lowers the anxiety. You can't artificially inflate their confidence by doing other things that don't make them feel like I'm prepared. Make sense?
And I'm sure Nick has heard me say this, Nick from NWA,
that I told my kids how the test works. I'm like, you are going to see content you don't know. And that's okay. Because they would like, because they get that nervous. They're like, I don't know these words. You know, like I'd have a kid who'd see like cosine. They're like, what does this mean? I'm like, it is fine. You are going to see words and phrases you have no idea, and that's okay. Because, and I would explain like how they give you a harder question, they give you up, down, that it's a constant movement throughout. I saw you moving over.
That just reminded me of something that we are doing in Wayne Westland right now. It's brand new. We are, I have thoughts, you'll have thoughts, but we are beginning to do some test prep in our classrooms, but we're only doing like an SAT problem of the day. So in our core classes, 11th grade, they're putting an SAT-like question up on the board, walking the students through that, helping them tear it apart. And it, that way they're hoping to familiarize themselves with the question types that they're going to see on that test. Because some of the students, they open up that test for the first time and they've never seen anything like it. So I think that this is one way, we're not trying to teach them to the test, but teach them how to, what to expect when they open that test and start looking at those questions. Like, oh, this looks familiar. I've seen this format before. I know what I'm expected to do. They might not know the content. They might not know, and that's okay, but they won't get freaked out when they're looking through, you know, multiple questions, scrolling through the screen. It's not going to be the first time they've seen questions in that format. It's something new we're trying this year. Will it work? We'll find out next year.
Where in which they actually teach medical students how to deconstruct question stems. And it's proven in research and it's proven in practicality. It will work. I actually just asked my team to do the exact same thing. So, yes, it's going to yield positive results.
Well, that is very promising to hear, as we have put together many. The instructional coaches were tasked with putting together slide decks with questions, SAT-like questions, with explanations as to the correct answer, why it was right, why this answer was wrong, how do you approach this. Next year, we are implementing, we're offering a course, an SAT prep course next year. We're going to target 11th graders on the bubble, where they will engage in a one-semester course that is test prep heavy. I got thoughts. You got thoughts. Will it work? We're going to see, but we got to try something. So these are the two things that we are doing to try to reduce that anxiety and prepare our students for the high stakes test.
Well, you know, here's part of that magic sauce again. Like, what can you do now today? Like, tap that student agency and involvement button. Like, ask the kids. Like, how confident do you feel? What would make you feel more prepared? Right? Demystifying. I think we spoke earlier about like making it transparent, demystifying, like, what is a scary thing, you know, SAT or NWA? What are people going to do with this data? Right? You know, will I get into college? Right? So demystifying that for the kiddos is, you know, a way to help improve their confidence and reduce their anxiety. Yes, it's a shameless plug for FAME, because through the formative assessment process, as Margaret Heritage would say, process, we can build learner confidence not by events, not even by slide decks. No disrespect to my girl Julie. Wayne Westland doing great stuff. But in the everyday moment of their metacognition every single day and every single point throughout classroom instruction. So FAME is really great to do that. We thank you for our time here today. We're a little early, so steal things from the vendors. You all got contracts with them anyway, so think of it like your district paid for it anyway.
And they don't want to take it on the plane home.
They don't want to take it on the plane home. That is your pencil. That is your fidget.
That's your sticker.
That's your sticker. You go get it. Okay? If you ever want to talk to any of us about some of these ideas or even things that you are trying, feel free to contact any of us. We've had a lovely time with you today. But if anything, we do want you to do something. Don't leave the room and say, oh, that was cool. Do a something, no matter your role, if you're a principal, assistant principal, coach, data coordinator, MTSS coordinator, ISD person, whatever you can use in your corner of the universe, the faith the size of a mustard seed can move mountains. Be that mustard seed today. And thanks for joining us. Oh, wait. Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot. Yeah, almost forgot. All right. Real quick. Who is within their first 4 years of, okay, what year are you? This is your first year. Is anybody else is their first year? Okay, all right, 2 and 2. There you go. Bam. And your first year. All right, get out of here. Now you're a winner. Winner, chicken dinner. Like first year where like, oh, I was one of those teachers that like whoever raised their hand first, like, oh, okay, yeah. Bad pedagogy.